I've been driving a bus to Sahegan the last 5 summers. Sahegan's located right at the end of Lake Chelan. We would have got cut on the boat. We would have ended up there in about a half an hour. It's a community of about 85 people year round. And in the summer, that community expands quite a bit with most of the tourism happening in the summertime. That's what the last 5 summers and a couple of the last 5 winters working at. The program tonight is just going to be on the history, pretty much, of Sahegan. I'd be happy to answer any other questions if you have them, or while I'm talking, also feel free to interrupt if I'm not finding something that you have. How did you get into Sahegan for? Oh, I remember. Great.
I'm not going to start the slides right away, John. Well, I think I'm not going to start the slides for just right now, but you could turn the lights off if you want to, or you can leave them on. It doesn't really matter. Why don't you leave them on until the slides start? Yeah, right, the next couple minutes. The history, at least the white human history of Sahegan starts in 1814, when a guy named Alexander Ross, who was working for the British, the Northwest Fur Company, was assigned to come explore this area, and he chose to come up the Sahegan Valley and try to go over Cascade Pass. The area had never been explored by white people before, although it had been used extensively by Indians for, I don't know, who knows, 100 years before that period of time. In fact, Sahegan, the word, means the way through. At least that's what a lot of people was originally thought the word meant. There's recent evidence that it indicates it might be the turning around point, Sahegan, so nobody even knows what the names mean exactly. But it's appropriate either way, because the Indians that gave it the name were the Skagit Indians, and they'd come over from the Skagit River, the western side of the mountains. They'd come over Cascade Pass down into the Sahegan Valley to trap, to hunt, basically just to spend their summers. And then they'd usually, at the end of the summer, the fall, they'd head back over the mountains and go back into the Skagit River area where the winters were a lot more mild, where food was a lot more plentiful. Occasionally they would, though, in the summer, once they got to Sahegan, canoe down to where Chelan now is. They'd store dugout canoes and trade with the Chelan and Okanagan Indians. So for them, the Cascade Pass was a way through some of the time, and for most of the time probably it was the turning around point. In 1814, a guy named Alexander Ross came in to explore for trading route possibilities. Since nobody had ever been in here, they hired an Indian guide to take them over Cascade Pass. They're hoping to get to the coastal area. That was sort of a sacred area up there for the Indians, and they were usually not willing to go alone, only with parties, but they convinced this Indian to go with them, Ross did. They got over Cascade Pass and were within 50 miles or so of reaching the coast when there was a big lightning and thunderstorm. The Indian got pretty scared. In the middle of the night, he left, went back over this side of the Cascades and headed back to where he'd started from. Ross woke up and his party woke up without any guide left, so they decided to turn around also, since they really didn't know exactly where they were. They just retraced their steps over Cascade Pass and came back in to the eastern side of the state. So that trip wasn't totally successful. The next really exploration that happened wasn't until quite a few later. In 1882, a guy named Lieutenant Henry Pierce came in with an army expedition. They were researching mineral possibilities. He found some mineral potential up near Cascade Pass, wrote a report, and that's sort of what started the mining boom in this area, at least in Sahegan, the particular portion of Sahegan. That report generated a lot of interest in miners. People started really flocking into Sahegan, and that's really where the history of white settlement starts. So just about 100, just a little over 100 years ago.
Yeah, only way to deal with that.
Lake for their entrance to the city again? Or did he come via land?
Lieutenant Pierce's company came via land. They came over a place called War Creek Pass, which is just above the lake. They could actually see the lake from the part of their route, but they didn't canoe up the lake. I'm not really sure why. That would seem to be the easiest way, but
how about Ross?
I'm not sure exactly how it came over. I think it was over Bridge Creek, which is a, which is another stream coming from where the North Cascades Highway now passes through. That initial boom was composed mostly of just individual prospectors and miners who, this area of the country attracted a lot of those people. In fact, sort of the history of Skowhegan parallels in some ways the history of Holden Village. Initial claims were discovered approximately the same time, within a decade, and the mining really ended almost the same time, within just 2 or 3 years. So there's really similar in a lot of ways. They're really dissimilar in a lot of ways too, since mining in Holden was very profitable and successful. Mining in Skowhegan, for the most part, was not. A few of the people that attracted that are well known still are Dan DeVore. You can see him up in the upper corner, and his horse, Old Bill, and his dog Whiskers. You can sort of see a family resemblance there. Dan lived at a, for a lot of the time, it's just right at the end of the lake, Chelan, on the opposite side of where Skowhegan is now. He came up to prospect. He found out pretty quickly that there was a lot more money to be made in packing, and so he packed the prospectors up there and pretty much earned whatever money they happened to find. He'd also lived at Lucerne quite a long time and packed people up to Holden, this Holden area too. You can hike over from Holden right here if you head straight over the ridge, right down into Skowhegan over DeVore Pass, down DeVore Creek. Another pretty well-known group, family of people were the Weavers, and they came to Skowhegan, lived in the same general area, had a taxidermy shop, were also prospectors, and also began to really make their money off of the crowd that started to come to Skowhegan a little later. And one of the more colorful guys probably was Bill Buzzard. I'll talk a little bit more about Bill. He was another prospector who ended up moving out of the valley after selling his properties to some homesteaders. He didn't seem to ever make a lot of money in Skowhegan area, although before he came to Skowhegan and after he left, he made some money in various parts of the country, but usually ended up blowing it on alcohol and gambling. After, as that initial mining boom became more well known throughout the state, throughout the country, people started coming up. There was steamboats started coming up the lake to transport the people and the equipment. Different hotels began to be built to accommodate some of the tourism and also to accommodate the miners as they set out into the hills. The building on the left was the Argonaut Hotel, which was built in 1893. The building on the right was the starting of the Field House Hotel, which was started in 1900 and then completed in 1907. So what really surprises me as I look at the figures about Skowhegan, it only was it from 1890s, it was only a decade after that, or 15 years, before there was 200 or 300 people in the valley. And only maybe 10 years after that, or if you, at least if you believe the newspaper reports in Chelan, there was upwards of maybe 2,000 people in the hills. So the population really expanded rapidly, as it did, that's a pretty typical story, I guess, throughout the West in mining history, but expanded rapidly, and then when no money was to be made, a lot of those people left.
But the tourist industry had built up to the point where it didn't become a ghost town. Fieldhouse was probably one of the most, well, the most famous hotel in the area.
Is it still there?
No, the Fieldhouse had to be torn down in 1927 because a dam was built on the other end of the lake that raised the water up 21 feet. So they had to tear down this hotel, and they built another hotel in its place, which wasn't near as spectacular.
Steve, what mountain is that?
That's Mount McGregor, which is the mountain you can see when you enter Stehekin, and that's the most prominent peak. If off to the left, you can barely see another peak popping up there. In that area is Cascade Pass, where most of the mining activity took place, close to 30 miles from that point.
More of the traffic came in from this side then than from like Marble Mount?
Yeah, because there was transportation on the lake. Over Marble Mount, there's no roads, and so anybody that had to do that would take over.
Down. How about Ross, first name? Is he in from the west side or from this side?
Ross came in from this side.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
East side.
I guess the trappers and miners previously had, when they wanted to get to the east side of the Washington, had to go clear down to the Columbia River and follow the river up, and then come back up here. That's what they were trying to do, was to try to find a shorter transportation route through the mountains. And Cascade Pass was one of the more likely ones. One of the main things that made Fieldhouse so famous was it was owned by one of the first state legislatures. So he had a lot of influence. Well, he was well known, at least through parts of the country, and so drew people from around the nation. Early in its history, like about 1915 or so, the Northern Pacific Railroad bought it, and they could transport people from all over the United States. Back then, you know, it was pretty difficult to travel by vehicles because the roads weren't too good, so people preferred to travel by train. The Northern Pacific ran to Wenatchee, and then a steamboat ran up the Columbia close to Chelan, and then you had to drive in a car for just a couple miles and then hop on another boat before you got to Stehekin. So it was considered a really relatively easy place to get to compared to a lot of other places. So there's lots of people coming to Stehekin. In fact, I think, if you read the figures, I think more people came to Stehekin in the early 1900s than are coming today, at least to spend overnight, I should say. Today there's a lot of people who come up just to spend the afternoon, but more people, from what I can tell, came to spend overnight 70 years ago, 80 years ago, than do today, which is a little ironic. Now this is a picture taken above. You can see that white shape sort of in the middle of the screen. That's the Fieldhouse Hotel, and that's where the lake used to be. Today the lake, in the summertime anyway, extends in back of the Fieldhouse Hotel. And all that area now, if you go up to Stehekin now, all that area is just what they call mud flats. There's just a lot of mud or snow if there's enough snow in the winter. And that whole area is covered.
The dam was built when, about 1910?
1927 the dam was built.
Are these pictures taken, slides taken of old pictures? Is that where you got these?
Yeah, these pictures, yeah.
Hey, Steve.
Uh-huh?
How deep is the alluvium there at the old house?
Spence, how deep is it, Spence?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm not positive either.
79.5 feet.
Anyway, as it became a more popular place, steamboats started coming up the lake. The mining activity continued to decrease in the Cascade Pass area. Relatively early, there was a report of $10,000 of groceries being brought up to Bridge Creek, which is about 16 miles up from Stehekin. $10,000 in those days was, as you can imagine, was quite a bit of money, so there must have been quite a bit of an activity, and a lot of activity on the steamboats coming up. And
how did they get the steamboats to Lake Chelan?
Well, some of them were built there and some of them were hauled
from the Columbia up?
Mm-hmm. Taken from the Columbia and then hauled overland. I don't know. There's a whole history of different boats, and some of them were built in the Midwest even and brought clear out here. And I'm not positive how that was done. But I think most of the boats were built in the general area and just put on the lake here.
Those were party boats coming up?
Boats sort of like today, just transportation boats, delivering mail to people along the way, delivering tourists and delivering miners. The only way to really get up to Stehekin. There was also several different cabins up in the higher country where miners tended to live, at least during the summertime as they were prospecting. It looked like a pretty fancy place.
Lodge.
Chalet 4. These are all, I'm not positive where this picture is taken, probably up in the Cascade Pass or area.
One before there looks like the basin there. It
looks similar, I'm not sure if, it looks a little more broad to me than, but I'm not, it could be. That's, Horseshoe Basin was where some of the bigger mines.
Park Service employees?
Yeah. It's amazing to look at these pictures and to think of the kind of lifestyle these guys must have lived when they were mining.
Sort of like
us. Yeah. Most of the mining was done just during the summers. There was a one winter when the guys decided to mine through the winter up in Horseshoe Basin area. So they got a group of 30 men together and the cook that cooked their food, and they just hold it up to help. They stayed inside the mine all winter long. There was 30 feet of snow that winter, and the cook had a hard time when she was just, using the wood stove, keeping the stove pipe above the level of snow so the smoke would go up. Every so often she had to go out and add a couple more links of stove pipe. By the end of the winter, when the snow started melting, she counted 30 links of stovepipe she added onto that thing to keep above the level of snow. The men, there was 30 of them, they worked in three different shifts, going 8 hours a day, 8 hours, so they were working 24 hours a day. And by the end of that winter, the stories you get, they were pretty glad it was over. One guy came out, and his sister was the cook, he came out and hiked down to Stehekin, got on the boat, the day he got there, and they never heard from him again.
Did they make any money?
Well, they weren't making much. No, they were looking for gold primarily, and they never found enough of it to make any money. They did get some silver out of there, mostly going after galena, which is which contains silver and gold. But they really didn't make any money. The only guys who made money that I can really find out that made a lot of money were the two guys that originally staked that claim, Pershing and Kingman. They staked the claim in late 1890s, and then 2 years later, they sold that claim for $30,000. And the people who bought it never made any money. You can walk up in those mines today. The Park Service has reinforced them and sort of go back and examine some of the mining area, and it's just hard to imagine living underground like that for a winter, like they had to do.
This was, which year was it they wintered over there?
1909-1910. Like I said, today you can go up in that area and still explore some of the old mines that are open to public. Probably the most famous is the Black Warrior Mine, the waterfall coming down right beside it. You can get up there and see a lot of the old artifacts, drill bits, things left behind.
Is that Rainbow Falls there?
No, that's Rainbow Falls is about 3 miles up the valley, and this mine is about close to 30 miles up. You have to hike to it. The idea of some of the views I saw from there. Another reason they didn't make much money was transportation difficulties there. Yeah, I didn't take this one. They had to, it's sort of interesting. When they brought the mine out on railroad cars, they brought it to the end of the line, and then in sacks, they lowered it down these ledges to the basin below where people below loaded it onto donkeys and horses. Donkeys and horses took it down about 4 miles to where there was a road, and then they reloaded onto wagons. The wagons took it down to Stehekin, which took about 3 days. And then in Stehekin, they reloaded onto barges. And from there, it went down to Chelan, and they had to drive it from those, well, they had to load it off the barges onto trucks, which drove ways, and then loaded it onto trains, which took it to Tacoma. So it was just a lot of handling, a lot of hours involved, and the ore wasn't rich enough grade to really make the profit. There were a few people came to Stehekin they came first to mine, they decided they weren't going to make any money, but loved the area so much they decided to homestead. Probably the most famous of those people is the Buckners. Harry Buckner is the one that lived there most of his life. His father came in 1898, and then Harry, as a child, came up in 1911. And decided to start an apple orchard. You can see the trees in the background there. Started an apple orchard and continued to live there the rest of his life from 1911 to 1976, and that's when he died. His wife still lives in the area.
Steve is the one who picked apples.
Yeah. The apple orchard's still there. The land was sold to the Park Service 10 years or so ago, and the trees now are still producing apples. They're available for people in the community to come and pick. And also the bear and the deer tend to get their share too. If you come up to Stehekin in the summer, there's historic walks through the old homestead. When Buckner came up to the area, the Buckners were from Southern California, got tired of the city life, were looking for a place to move to, and they, I guess, must have been fairly well off because they were looking places as far as Alaska and at least examining potential places down in South America to move to. They passed through the area and came to Stehekin, saw it was a place they wanted to buy some land, found Bill Buzzard, who owned this piece of property, and asked him if he could sell it. If he would be willing to sell it. And at that point he was. I guess he was just itching to move on. So he said he'd make a deal. He'd sell it to him for $5,000 for the 140 acres, I think there was. They agreed to do that and were ready to pay him when he reconsidered. He'd had so much problem in the past with losing big amounts of money quickly that he said he changed his mind and would sell to him for $50 a month for the rest of his life, as long as he lived. They weren't sure if they were willing to do that, not knowing how long the guy would live. But they wanted the property, so they paid it. And as the story turned out, Bill Buzzard died $50 short of that original $5,000 agreement. And the Buckners used the $50 to pay for his grave and his Denmark National Land. There's a funny story with when Harry Buckner first came up, one of the first times he was coming up, his father was already here starting to work on the land, and his father had a list of items for him to buy down in Chelan, including some blasting powder, dynamite, things like that, to blast out some of the old stumps. See, Bill Buzzard had, those steamboats, when they come up, require 6 cords of wood per trip, which is quite a bit of wood. In Holden, we use maybe a family uses 6 cords for the winter to heat their house. So they were paying people along the lake to supply wood for them, and Bill Buzzard got one of the contracts. I think it sold for $1 a cord. Cut and delivered. So Bill could make $6 a day. What he'd do is cut it down and round it, and he'd keep $2 and pay kids $4 to split it and deliver it. So he's making a couple bucks a day doing that. Anyway, by the time the Buckners bought the place, there was a bunch of stumps left around and a lot of land. It was good for them because they wanted to plant an apple orchard, but there was a lot of stumps they couldn't get out, so they had to blast them out. Well, anyway, Buckner, who was 11 years old, got together this list in Chelan, brought the blasting powder and dynamite and stuff up on the boat, which was illegal for those steamboats that run on, you know, wood, fire. On the way up, he didn't tell anybody because he was a little young and scared. On the way up, there was a fire started on the boat. He didn't know exactly what to do. He decided he could either throw the suitcase containing the stuff overboard and just, by doing that, admit his guilt or hide them, keep them hidden, and hope the fire didn't reach the blasting powder. And it turned out they didn't, and he got to Stehegan safely, and the history of the Buckneys, so he goes on. Their homestead now, like I said, it still exists, and people take tours all summer long through there. Being from Southern California, Harry had never seen snow on the ground before. When he was 19 years old, he decided to spend his first winter by himself. And that first winter, there accumulated 10 feet of snow on the ground, which is a record, at least from this point on, since I'd been keeping weather records. So he felt that if he could make it through that first winter of 10 feet of snow, that he could make it through probably almost any winter. And like I said, he continued to live there the rest of his life, marrying and having children. When he first came in 1911, the population of Stehegan had gone back down to 10 or 11 people from that mining boom in the late 1890s and early 1900s. And from that 10 or 11, it slowly increased. But it hasn't been really until the last 20 years, maybe, that the population of Stehegan has really, again, started to experience a pretty big increase in population.
What is the current population?
Current population is about... turn on the lights. Current population is about 85 people year-round. So... let me just check notes here and see if there's any important thing I forgot to say.
How about McGregor? Didn't he have the mountain was named after him, wasn't it up here?
McGregor Mountain was named after a prospect, but we don't really know a whole lot about him.
Did you run the post office up there?
No, that was Buckner.
Buckner. Okay.
Yeah, Buckner ran the post office, and it was the Buckner Mountain was named after his father.
Okay.
Right, Harry Buckner.
Who planted all the hay that the Courtneys have right up?
Alongside the road?
Mm-hmm.
They did.
That was Courtneys?
Uh-huh.
They bought that from somebody else.
Well, they're leasing that property. It's Park Service. The Courtneys are another family that have been in Stehegan for quite a while. Hugh Courtney came up in 1918. I know some of you might have heard of Ray Courtney, the Ray Courtney family. They run horseback trips out of Stehegan, and they have been doing so for quite a long time. I just learned the other day, Ray worked up at Holden for a period of time here in the mine, and I think some of his brothers did too. But the family pretty much has grown up and stayed in Stehegan. You go up to Stehegan, there's a few families like that, maybe three or four, that have lived there basically their entire lives. Most of the people you meet in Stehegan today have lived there probably no more than a decade. There's a few that have lived there maybe 20 or 30 years, but it's a relatively new population. In 1968, the Park Service acquired the property from the Forest Service. It's always been Forest Service land, or at least has been since 1907, I think. The Park Service acquired that property. It was made into a national recreation area, and as a result of that, the land became a lot more valuable. A lot of the people that owned large parcels began to sell them off to make money, and a lot of new people began to move in. And sort of the feeling, I think, of Stehegan has been changing pretty radically over the last 20 years. A lot of new people, a lot of retired people, a lot of younger people. At least live there for a short period of time, and you don't get such a sense of really pioneers.
There still is that sense, but it's not overwhelming. Like, I would suspect it would have been 20 years ago, maybe. Piece of trivia was, 1946, The Courage of Lassie, the movie The Courage of Lassie, was filmed in Stehekin area. It was starred Elizabeth Taylor. It was Elizabeth...
She played Lassie?
She played...
she played Lassie?
It was Elizabeth's first movie ever. And actually, it wasn't. It didn't star Elizabeth, it starred Lassie. And Elizabeth said, she's very well remembered for that movie. Every once in a while, a movie shows in Stehekin, and it's really funny just to see, just to recognize certain parts. But I get it, when I heard when they were filming this movie, they had the barges brought all the movie equipment up, and one of the barges was overloaded with equipment and food for the cast, all that kind of stuff, and it sank about 2 miles down lake. Had a bunch of watermelons on board, and all the food, all those watermelons and other things started floating around the lake, and all the local people took their canoes or what boats out and started gathering up all the food. It was great. So the recent history has been, since 1968, the Park Service has controlled most of the property. There still is private land up there. People still do make a living. Today, like it has been historically, most of the money is made off of tourism activities. The apple orchard that Buckner's ran was really the only commercially successful operation that ever made it in Stehekin. Mining didn't make it. Dairy production didn't make it. It's pretty bad for large-scale farming, the soil and the property. And so really it's always been and probably always will continue to be based sort of around tourism. But if you get a chance to go up there, I think it would be... Well, you will go up there when you leave Olden for half an hour anyway, so... Because the boat continues on up to Stehekin, but... Take time to visit up there if you have a chance to. Yeah, Ben.
Did the Stehekin School continue on this time, or has it started up again since the population?
Well, the Stehekin School was originally started in 1921. And it operated for a while, then shut down for a period of 15 or 20 years around World War II, and then started up again. When they first started up, they were only operating 3 or 4 months out of the year, however much they could pay the teacher. I think the first full year's budget that they ran was for 7 months. It was $750 for the year. The teachers paid $90 a month. They built the school just from donations and stuff, so it was a pretty low budget operation, but it's operating now full time, and there's first through eighth grades up there with what, maybe how many people, Tammy, this year? 11 students or so. No, I don't. Teachers make quite a bit more than that now. I don't know how.
When did it become part of Anson School?
No, I really don't know when it entered the Schlein School District. Yeah, okay, that's right. That's right. It's our own school district.
Okay.
You're right. Sorry.
Could you tell us about Bill Buzzard? Is that his name?
Yeah. Bill Buzzard, there's probably one of the most humorous stories about Bill Buzzard was when he lived in Eagle City, Iowa.
That's
humorous.
Yeah.
Eagle City.
Maybe it's Idaho. I can't remember right now. But anyway, he was a prospector.
They're somewhere by Nebraska.
Yeah. It's Idaho, I think, yeah. Sorry. He was a prospector. He had decided to try to make a little extra money in land speculation. He was building a house, went out to do some hunting, came back to the house after a week or so to find another guy from Portland, Oregon who was looking at his property. This guy had come into the town not knowing that Buzzard owned the property and was met by some outlaws, I guess, in the community who had been sort of running things. They were trying to sell him the deed to the land, but he found through other means that it was Buzzard that really owned it. So when Buzzard came back, these guys came out to meet Buzzard and told him to get off his property. They wanted to sell it. And he said, there's no way I'm going to get off my property. So they rode back,
gathered the gang together, came out with a bunch of guns to get him off. They started. He heard him approaching. A friend was sitting there talking, and the Buzzard told his friend, "You better get in the house. There's going to be a commotion here." The guys rode up. The guy, his friend, didn't get off this log soon enough. The shooting started. The guy, his friend, fell down dead. Buzzard started firing with his rifle from behind the corner of their house. Sort of accidentally, I think, shot the leader's ear off, and blood started spreading through this guy. That broke up this gang's spirit. They rode home sort of defeated, and the whole town, who expected Buzzard to be dead, you know, the next day, saw him riding into town later on that day, and through that means basically kicked this gang out of the town and kept him from operating. So he became known as the man who cleaned up Eagle City.
We always wondered who did.
Bill Buzzard, yeah, but I don't know, after he left Skahikan, I think he died penniless. He just sort of wasted the rest of his life away.
Did the other guy become a painter?
I don't know. Is there any other questions?
Thanks, Steve.
Who built the Holden line? Well, I'm not the best one to ask about the question. From what I understand, the people who really developed it was the House Sound Mining Company, but it had been operating to some extent, to a lot less extent earlier than that by private individuals and by some investors. But it was really the House Sound Mining Company, and
they started.
Yeah, they started major scale in what, 1938?
J.H. Holden came through in 1896, and if there wasn't snow, you could see the sites of the early mines. But House Sound spent 3 years exploring the feasibility of this site, and they built it in 1 year. Essentially in 1 year in 1938. They spent $5 million before they took a penny out in the late 1930s. That was a real venture. And then mined it for 20 years with the $100 million gross and $5 million net profit, and the mine was, the core was really fairly well gone. They had estimated 20 years, and it was within 3 months of their estimate that they quit.
Really? Yes.
It's 56 miles of tunnel in Copper Mountain across the creek, and 1,500 feet from the entrance down. They were mining below Railroad Creek when they quit, which was another reason it was a lot more difficult to get the ore out. And they had almost as much transportation, not quite, but they had trucks 24 hours a day going down to the dock, and then barges to Chelan, and then the trucks to the railroad to Tacoma. So they had an expensive operation too. It was fine while the price of copper was high, especially Second World War. But by 1958, it was not profitable anymore. So they walked away from it.
Were there any other possible sites that they explored?
What I meant was, if there was no snow, you could see Honeymoon Heights, and above that, copper tailings. And there are some old photographs of the bunks where the miners stayed way up when J.H. Holden and other individuals did it. But it took that kind of investment. It took a major road, and it took the kind of processing. There are 80 acres of tailings out here covered by snow, so you have some idea of what they took out of that mountain. 80 acres on the surface, and I don't know, what are they? How high? Probably 10.
56
miles. Our mine is not open, so I can't invite you to this.
Right. Yeah.